Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
We're in the midst, I believe, of a burgeoning food movement where people are going to farmers markets more regularly. They're supporting community-supported agriculture programs, community gardens. And the more that that happens, the more we're going to see factory farms pushed away.
That's Gene Bauer, president and co-founder of Farm Sanctuary. He stops by the Earth Eats studios to talk about how his organization is working to improve living conditions for farm animals. Later in the program, can you really call it a weed if you can eat it? Hear what Chef Dee Dee Emmons thinks about that. And we prepare sautéed dandelion greens in the kitchen, along with a no-bake suet cake to feed the birds in your neighborhood. Stay with us. Mia Partlow brings us food news headlines every week. What you got for us?
I've got three stories from this week's food headlines. On Wednesday, the USDA announced it would provide farmers markets with $4 million in grants to participate in SNAP, the federal program commonly known as food stamps. Agriculture Deputy Secretary Kathleen Merrigan says the opportunity to accept food stamps would expand farmers markets' ability to provide fresh and healthy food to everyone. There are an estimated 46 million Americans who use food stamps. At least 14 people in 9 states have fallen ill in a salmonella outbreak linked to several brands of dry pet food made by Diamond Pet Foods. Humans can contract salmonella from contaminated dog food by handling tainted kibble or having contact with a pet that has eaten it. Health officials recommend always washing your hands after handling pet food or pets, especially if you plan to handle food or feed children. And there's a food fight brewing in California. 8 years ago, legislation banning the sale of foie gras was signed into law by former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. It is set to go into effect in a little under 2 months, on July 1st. But forces both for and against the moratorium are now locked in an 11th-hour battle to defend the law or have it repealed. Foie gras is made from the livers of ducks or geese, but not just any liver will do. To produce the desired texture and flavor, birds must be force-fed several times a day. Animal rights activists consider the ban to be an important victory for animal welfare. On the other side, the most vocal opponent of the ban is San Francisco chef Chris Consentino. He advises animal rights advocates seeking to make a difference to target factory farms, saying, quote, "You know what else we shouldn't eat? 99-cent hamburgers that are spreading salmonella. But is the solution banning hamburgers? No, it's fixing the system," unquote. Read more about these stories and add your 2 cents on our website, eartheats.org.
Some of the most interesting conversations happen on our Twitter and Facebook pages, so check us out there by searching for Earth Eats. Mia Partlow, always good to have you with us.
See you next week.
Hog farmers are under a lot of scrutiny these days. Animal rights advocates say that the efficient pork production system producers have developed over the last couple of decades is cruel and inhumane. That viewpoint is gaining traction, which scares some farmers. They worry that animal rights groups will parlay moral qualms with certain hog farming techniques into legislation banning them. In Missouri, the General Assembly is poised to pass legislation that essentially would lock in the legality of current methods. But Harvest Public Media's Jessica Najunas reports that the marketplace may have the final word.
There's just one independent hog broker left in Missouri, and you'll find him at the intersection of two major rural roads in Osage County.
I run Central Hog Market, LLC. Rick Backs is my name.
Central Hog Market is an open-air truss barn that provides temporary housing for hogs that will depart for processing plants within hours of their arrival. Bax's barn can hold up to 300 animals. One recent shipment had 18 antibiotic-free hogs. Right now, they're the loudest.
I look at a pig and I see two loins, two hams, two bacons, some nice pork steaks.
The sales are conducted in a small office with particle board walls with signs that say things like, "America's best pork depends on good livestock handling."
Most of these farmers will be good husbands of the animals. We just don't need special interest groups, you know, trying to put their I don't want to say city ways, but different ways on this rural area.
But that's exactly what's happening. More and more, consumers take an interest in how their food is produced, even if they've never been in a hog barn or raised an animal. Missouri State Representative Tom Lerner says that's a disturbing trend.
I always knew that there was a rub between the urban areas and the rural areas. I did not realize how many people did not understand where their food came from. Then you didn't have to kill an animal to get what you was going to eat. Well, we get our food from the store.
So Lerner has sponsored a bill that would protect Missouri farmers from consumer whims.
It shall be the right of persons to raise livestock in a manner adhering to state and local laws and ordinances as enacted as of August 28, 2012, or at the commencement of operations, whichever is later.
As he reads, Lerner sits in an office with a Missouri River view. Behind him on the wall is a taxidermy wreath fashioned from barbed wire. In the center, a game bird is frozen in flight. He says farmers have spent lots of money building businesses with techniques now under attack.
It's going to cost them hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars to do that and change their whole operations. And when they're out, they're out.
But for animal rights activists, a farmer's financial loss doesn't mean much. It's a moral issue, right from wrong. Animal rights activist Temple Grandin has compared farming methods such as confining a pregnant pig to a crate, like living your life sitting in a coach class airline seat. And farmer and author Nicolette Han Nyman says that if Sweden and the UK can ban crates, then it shouldn't be an issue for the US.
If it violates the basic, you know, fundamental values that we have, just our gut instinct tells us this is wrong, then it is wrong.
Her husband founded Nyman Ranch, one of the original suppliers of pork to Chipotle. The ranch still works with farmers who raise animals outdoors and crate-free.
When you consider, you know, the overall welfare of the animals involved, it's a small price to pay for all of those, you know, many, many hours of suffering that are avoided by allowing them to be out of the crates.
And this view is changing the market. This year, McDonald's, Hormel, and the largest producer of pork in the country, Smithfield, vowed to stop buying pork from farmers who raise hogs in crates. Carl Esbeck is a professor of law at the University of Missouri and says if you have a good product and you meet some consumer demands, you'll likely succeed.
This law would skew the pure marketplace because it gives one group in the debate a leg up where they can, if they're starting to lose out, they can say, well, we have this legal right, and that trumps whatever your arguments are to the contrary.
Think of Apple or Nike, Esbeck says. Those companies are subject to consumer worries over products made with cheap labor abroad, but people still buy iPhones and running shoes.
Two very large, successful American industries have entered into the marketplace, made accommodations, made adjustments, but nonetheless are able to manufacture cheaply and compete. I would think agribusiness in Missouri could do the same, and they don't need this law, which would codify for them a right of the status quo.
The Right to Raise Animals bill has failed three times, but it recently passed the Missouri House and is currently being considered by state senators. Jessica Najunas, Harvest Public Media.
Last month, an undercover video released by the Humane Society offered a behind-the-scenes glimpse into conditions at a Kreider Farms egg factory. The footage shows hens crammed into 54 square-inch cages, mummified carcasses strewn among the living, a thick layer of dead flies covering the floor, among other things. It's conditions like this that organizations like Farm Sanctuary fight against through advocacy, education, and animal rescue. In fact, with their locations in New York and California, Farm Sanctuary is the largest rescue and refuge network for farm animals in North America. Gene Bauer is the president and co-founder of Farm Sanctuary. A vegan since 1985, Bauer has been called the conscience of the food movement.
Farm animals, like all animals, have feelings. They have deep emotional lives. They have complex cognitive abilities. They're not that different than cats or dogs, and they deserve to be treated with respect and compassion.
He stopped by the Earth Eats studios in Bloomington, Indiana, on a recent speaking tour. So how did a Hollywood, California kid get into farm animals?
Well, I grew up wanting to make a positive difference in the world is the bottom line. And as I, you know, as time went, I learned about different things. I got involved with human rights organizations and environmental organizations. Then I learned about factory farming and the many problems caused by it. And it was an issue that was not getting a lot of attention in the mid-1980s. So co-founded Farm Sanctuary, and I've been doing this work ever since.
I'm reluctant to ask this next question because I know what you're going to say. Tell me some of the things you've seen when you visited factory farms.
Well, you know, I've found living animals literally thrown in trash cans or left on piles of dead animals. And whenever possible, we rescue those animals. I've also seen animals put in cages, in crates, and packed so tightly they can't even turn around or stretch their limbs or move for their whole lives. These animals sometimes have bruises and abrasions on their bodies from constantly scraping against the metal bars of their enclosures. I found animals too sick to walk being dragged onto trucks and taken to slaughter to be used for human food. Sometimes they're pushed with forklifts, dragged with chains. The bottom line is that these are living, feeling animals, and they deserve better. They deserve to be treated with compassion and respect. And how we treat other animals says an awful lot about us. And at the end of the day, we should make food choices that we can feel good about instead of saying, don't tell me, I don't want to know, which is too often what people say when they hear about factory farming or when the topic comes up. Also, it's important to recognize that we can live and do very well by eating only plant foods and not eating any meat, milk, or eggs.
Well, then the next logical question is, in your ideal world, would we all be vegetarians or vegans?
In an ideal world, we would not be killing and eating other animals, in my ideal world. But you know, each person has their own opinion and may have another vision of what the ideal world looks like. But from my standpoint, killing is an inherently violent act, and it's one that we don't need to engage in. And for me, being vegan is a lifestyle. It's almost like a religion. So I would love other people to share my lifestyle and my religion just because I think it makes a lot of sense. But I also recognize that everybody has their own opinion. What I would encourage, though, is that people make decisions about their food that are aligned with their own values and aligned with their own interests.
About killing animals for food. So we're a local sustainable food show, and so we talk to a lot of farmers, and this one particular farmer is named Jim Fiedler. He raises certified organic grass-fed free-range cows, pigs, and chickens in southern Indiana on the Ohio River. And he said, quote, "We identify our pigs as happy pigs. They have one bad day, and I wish that's all I had in my life." What would you say to that?
Well, I would say that it's good that these animals are being given some decency in their lives, unlike most animals that are raised for food. But I would also say that in many cases, you have animals that are raised and slaughtered, and they're being marketed in a way that sounds a lot better than it is. And I cannot speak to this particular situation, but you know, the term free range, for example, makes people believe that these animals are outdoors free ranging. But free range only requires that animals be given access to the outdoors, and that's not defined. So you often have animals raised in warehouses with a small door that goes to a crummy little paddock, and that's technically free range when it doesn't really meet what most people would assume free range meets. So I think if people are going to buy animal foods, it's important to get to know the farmers, ideally go to farmers markets, maybe even visit the farms to see what's happening, because a lot of times these labels are very misleading.
What's happening in states like Iowa and Utah most recently, they have laws on the books now restricting taking photos and making videos in factory farms. They're calling them ag gag laws. So I wonder, from an activist point of view, what this means for the work that you do.
Well, I think it's very telling that this is an industry that is so concerned about the way its animals are treated that it's making it illegal to take pictures and to show people how these animals are being treated. And that speaks to the fact that these conditions are outside the bounds of acceptable conduct in our society. And I am not happy that the industry is pushing for and passing laws to make it illegal to videotape and show pictures of these animals. But I ultimately believe that the truth has a way of coming out. People are going to learn about what happens on factory farms. So I'm confident that citizens will continue to dig more into these issues as they've started to do and will ultimately, you know, reject factory farming, and change is going to have to happen.
Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you very much.
Chef Daniel Orr is in the kitchen preparing the ingredients for a homemade no-bake suet cake. This is a terrific little food item for attracting a wide variety of feathered friends to your house.
And this recipe is perfect for all kinds of woodpeckers and other birds that might be coming around to your backyard. And what we're going to do is just mix together a bunch of ingredients. It's no bake, so it's the easiest thing possible. I've got some lard right here. Then we're going to add some peanut butter. And we're just going to mix those two ingredients together until it forms a smooth paste. But it almost is going to look like a icing or peanut butter cookie mixture when you get this far. So you want to incorporate all those ingredients. And then if you need to, you can always add a little bit more flour. But you want to have a nice sturdy cake, because when the sun hits it, you don't want it to just melt and roll down your tree. And then we're just going to mix in all the other little grains. We've got some cornmeal. We've got some wonderful rolled oats. We've got some bird seed, which I have millet and sunflower seeds. I'm using some white raisins, but you could use any type of dried fruit or currants, and mix those right into your little suet cake for your birds. A funny thing is that we're going to add some cayenne pepper. A lot of people would think that birds wouldn't like cayenne pepper, but they love chilies. Okay, and then we just have some molds. What I've done is I've put a little bit, you could take a cat food can or any kind of little tin or a hummus container, rub a little bit of water inside, and then you push your plastic wrap in there, and it will stick to the water that you put inside there. So I've spread these evenly inside, and then what we do is we take that, we put it in the freezer, let it firm up, and then you can just pull them out, kind of tap them out once they're frozen. You've got these wonderful little cakes.
Check out the recipe and see a photo on our website. Find plenty of other recipes while you're there, including a mango nectarine salsa and springtime asparagus pasta, eartheats.org. Coming up,
we think of weeds as something you have to pull out, and they are invasive and you need to get rid of them. But, you know, these feisty little weeds are full of, you know, nutrients.
Chef Dee Dee Evans talks about why she embraces weeds in her cooking. And in the kitchen with Chef Daniel Orr, we sauté some dandelion greens with local sausage. Stay with us.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. Bloomingfoods.coop.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Urban gardeners don't let small plots of land or contaminated soil get in the way of growing food. Garden designer Jamie Scholl is taking it one step further by planting gardens throughout downtown Bloomington, Indiana that are fun and silly and eye-catching. She's getting help from several green-thumbed kids at Bloomington's Science Museum Wonder Lab. WFIU's Yael Cassander has more.
You might think Wonder Lab is kid stuff, but just a hypothesis here. What if a playful approach is just what is needed when it comes to tackling major issues, such as food insecurity brought on by global climate change?
It's more than just a bearded dragon in the ground.
Garden designer Jamie Scholl has high hopes for a mound of earth in the museum's Wonder Garden that she's been sculpting in the shape of a 10-foot-long bearded dragon.
So the community will be planting these plants that I've chosen. The mustards, kales vary in height and texture, so they will mimic the skin of the creature.
Not only will the kale, collards, and mustard plants approximate the look of the lizard's skin, they will double as sustenance for a real bearded dragon who lives at the museum. When she was proposing the project, that tie-in was key for Scholl.
I said, by the way, let's do something with the edible plants that's going to feed the creatures inside the science museum. So they, after a few days, got back to me with the plant list, and we ended up with this.
It may just look like the practice run for a sandcastle contest now, but the living sculpture Scholl is creating cross-pollinates several ideas often considered unrelated.
Agriculture, you know, plant your garden in the back 40, keep it back there, forget to weed it, it's not very pretty. But let's bring it to the front yard, let's put it near the house, let's make it beautiful, let's make it functional too. Beauty and functionality do not need to be separate.
Wonder Lab is one of several venues throughout Bloomington's Entertainment and Arts District showcasing Scholl's year-long project Garden the City 2012, Painting with Edibles. These highly visible urban garden plots are intended to do more than decorate the city. They'll provide object lessons in how to cultivate edible and medicinal plants in challenging and unexpected situations.
So people who aren't usually interested in food security, I want to create an opportunity for them because we all eat.
In addition to such challenges as growing food in places with contaminated soil, a major obstacle would-be urban gardeners face is a legal one. As a member of the Bloomington Food Policy Council, involved with the Urban Agriculture Amendment, Scholl has discovered that
going through the city's Unified Development Ordinance, or city's municipal code, there are covenants and restrictions, especially in neighborhoods.
Covenants restricting agricultural activity within certain subdivisions that are still on the books are a relic of the post-World War II era, Scholl explains, when the new American culture of material abundance was discomfited by any association with the gritty days of victory gardens.
When the men came back from World War II, you know, there's this whole shift in what was acceptable. That's when Levittown came into being. You know, we had this cookie-cutter kind of dream.
As a private consultant to clients trying to garden in the legal wake of that era, Scholl brings her art training to bear.
To me, it's just a design issue. But there are some legalities, and I can help them work around those legalities and still create something really beautiful in the front yard that's not a row crop. We don't have to plant row crops in our front yards.
In the Wonder Lab's side yard, the Wonder Garden, Scholl is helping children plant seedlings in the giant lizard made of soil.
So where should the hole be?
About right there.
Right there. Take the child. Go straight down.
We must all tend our garden, suggested Voltaire's optimist, Candide. Or, as his 21st century counterpart would conclude,
so gardens can save the world, yes.
For WFIU, I'm Yael Cassander.
Peter Del Tredici, scientist at Harvard University, has said, quote, I consider weed to be a politically incorrect term. There's no biological definition of the term weed. It's really a value judgment, unquote. Chef Dee Dee Emmons couldn't agree more. Her cookbook, Wild Flavors, celebrates her relationship with local New England farmer Eva Samaripa, whom she credits for introducing her to all sorts of feisty, flavorful, and nutritious plants.
For instance, I had a quinoa salad today for lunch, and I threw raisins and walnuts and a bunch of cilantro. And I just used that, and I didn't need any salad dressing. But it took me about 4 or 5 years before I started to like chickweed. But once you mix it in with a little bit of, say, cilantro and sorrel and a little lettuce, and you make a salad of it, it's like adding a little bit of vinegar to a soup. You know, you don't like vinegar straight up, but once it's added to the soup, it brings out all the flavors.
Some plants don't need much at all. They're pretty tasty eaten straight from the ground.
An example of that would be wood sorrel, oxalis, which is a tiny little plant or weed. And it tastes almost a little sweet. And you find that everywhere. And goosefoot, you find in people's lawns everywhere. And you just saute it in a little bit of olive oil, and it's like spinach. It's even more delicate than spinach.
When I'm looking here at the goosefoot pancakes.
Do
you remember this recipe? Can you talk me through this?
It's almost like a crepe. And these are things that you can just eat as a snack, or you can make fancy hors d'oeuvres and top it with a little sour cream, a little dollop of creme fraiche or goat cheese. But you chop the greens up, and you add it to the pancake batter. And they're bright green, and they're just tasty. I mean, I first tried them with 1 cup of greens, and then I think I ended up going up to 4 cups. And it just kept getting better.
You know, I was just flipping through this. There are a lot of dessert-y type recipes using greens, too.
Yeah. I mean, I think that chefs now are seeing the value of herbs that are quite savory, meaning they're not sweet at all. So herbs like oregano or basil or rosemary, and they'll use them with sweet treatments. So I have a shortbread recipe, you know, which is like a butter cookie, and I use juniper berries in them. But rosemary would be equally good, or lavender would be equally good. I put a bunch of sorbets in the book. There's a calamint sorbet. Calamint is an herb that's this cross between oregano and mint. And there's something about mixing sugar with these very earthy flavors that makes for this wonderful dessert.
Read the complete interview with Chef Dee Dee Emmons on our website, eartheats.org. And if you try making that calamint sorbet, write a comment to let us know how it tastes. Here's a savory dish using a weed or plant that's making a nuisance of itself all over the place these days, dandelions. Chef Daniel Orr starts the prep process by cutting the dandelion greens into 3-inch pieces.
Okay, we're going to add a little bit of olive oil. You don't need to use your most expensive extra virgin olive oil for this. It's going in at the very beginning of the cooking. You want to save your good extra virgin olive oils for finishing dishes like drizzling over pastas or using in salad dressings, because if you cook those nice green olive oils, you're just going to cook out the flavor. It'll actually evaporate into your exhaust fan. So you're just paying $16 a liter for nothing. So use your less expensive or mixed olive oil for this to get started. What I've done is I've tossed in my local sausage. What we want to do is to cook the sausage till it starts to brown. That way it develops some of the flavor. All right, once your sausage has started letting out some of the fat, starting to color, we're going to add some onions. And I'm also going to add my garlic at this time. And the aromas are starting to really come out. I love the smell of cooking onions and garlic. Once that sausage and onions have started to brown, you're going to add your potatoes. Now, you could do it two ways. You could either put them raw in here and then cook them a little bit longer, or you can do as I did today, and I have a selection of red, white, and blue potatoes that I've par-cooked ahead of time, so it's a little bit quicker cooking method. Okay, I also have a habanero pepper, a small little habanero pepper. Now, this is really spicy, but I love the flavor of it. So what I'm going to do to get the flavor without the spice is I'm going to add it whole, and then when it gives the flavor that I want, I can just remove it. Okay, and then finally I'm going to add our dandelion greens. I'm just kind of laying those across the top. And that almost forms a little lid over the potatoes and sausage mixture. I'm going to add a little bit of vegetable stock. And we're just going to let that come to a boil and steam for a little while. And now we're going to add the acid to the dish. And what we want to do is create what my grandfather called a pot liquor. And that's the juice that's in the bottom of a batch of greens. And we always put a little bit of vinegar. We even kept a cruet of vinegar on the dinner table that you could add to your pot liquor and drink it at the end of the bowl of greens.
Make sure to taste your dandelions. If they're too bitter, add a touch of honey. See the recipe on our website, eartheats.org.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 3 locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. Bloomingfoods.coop. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Carrie Boyce, executive producer.
Come back next week to hear our discussion with 2 master composters. And gardeners planting food on the roof of the Middleway House have run into some interesting challenges. Hear how they're coping. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for listening.